Welcome. You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining me today for another edition of The Lighter Side. I'm Jerry Podgorski. Today, again, we're going to hear from Bill Bryson, one of his older recordings, or one of his older columns, I should say. After Bill Bryson, we'll hear a bit from Irma Bombeck, and after that, we'll see what time we have left over for some internet humor. Here's one Bill Bryson called Life's Mysteries. I don't understand most things. I really don't. I am full of admiration for people who can talk knowledgeably about household wiring or torque ratios on their car engines, but that's not me, I'm afraid. I remember years ago, after buying my first car, being asked how big the engine was. Oh, I don't know, I said, quite sincerely. About this big, I suppose, and I spread my arms to the appropriate dimensions. It was about then I realized I was not cut out for technical discourse. So when I say I don't understand most things, I am quite sincere. I don't understand chemistry, anatomy, physiology, mathematics, beyond what is necessary to make small change, geophysics, astrophysics, particle physics, molecular biology, or newspaper weather maps, among much else. I don't know what an enzyme is, or an electron, or a proton, or a quark. Don't have the faintest idea. I don't even know my own body. I couldn't begin to tell you what my spleen does, or where you would look to find it. I wouldn't know my own endocrine glands if they reached out and goosed me. Nearly every technical marvel of our age is a source of mystery and wonder to me. Take the mobile telephone. I cannot, for the life of me, conceive how these things work. Imagine, for the sake of argument, that you are in New York and I am in a wheat field in Nebraska, and you call me up on my mobile phone. How does the signal that you have generated in New York know to come beaming down to me in a wheat field in Nebraska? And what exactly are our voices when they travel back and forth between the two phones? And why don't we have to shout to be heard? And if modern science can get a voice to travel through thin air and come out clearly thousands of miles away, why can't they deliver pizza in the same way? And what am I doing in a wheat field in Nebraska anyway? You see what I mean? I just don't understand most things. Here are some other things I have never been able to figure out. What did insects do at night before there were electric lights? Why is it that the more hair I lose off the top of my head, the more grows in my nostrils? When the phone rings, why does someone always say, "Is that the phone?" How do aquarium fish get so much energy out of a few little flakes of food? And what are those flakes made of, precisely? And how did anyone ever determine that that is what they want to eat? Why do elevators have signs that say, "Maximum load, 1,200 pounds, or something similar? And why do they always put the signs inside where it's too late to do anything about it? And what are you expected to do with this information anyway? Are you supposed to turn to the other occupants and say, I believe I'm about 210 pounds. I don't know how much do the rest of you weigh. Do you ask the heaviest people to step off until you have completed your calculations? Is it actually possible that there are people who can eat a, I can't believe it's not butter, and not believe it's not butter? Why is it that less leather there is in a woman's shoe, the more it costs? How did anyone ever invent solitaire? This has been bothering me for years. You could give me a pack of cards and all the time in the world, and still it would never occur to me to lay them out on equal piles and then turn the remaining cards over three at a time and to array those cards in descending order by alternate color and make four additional piles up on top and put cards there in ascending order by suit and all the rest of it. That just would never occur to me. Never. Why do we think someone from the bottom of the, why do we thank someone from the bottom of our heart? Why not the middle of our heart? Why not, indeed, the whole heart? Why not the heart, lungs, brains, spleen, etc.? Why couldn't Dick Vitale have found something quieter to do for a living? Why, when we do something foolish, do we say, oh, that will teach you to do such and such, when what we mean is, that will teach you not to do such and such? Why is it that phone calls in the middle of the night are always wrong numbers? Why are planes, trains, and buses on time when you are late, and late when you are on time? How is it that no matter how carefully you examine potted plants before purchasing, you always choose the one that has a terminal illness? How can my computer know when the clocks change between normal time and daylight saving time every spring and fall, and yet can't figure out when I want to italicize one little word? I mean just that one little word and not everything else that follows? Also, why is it that every time I switch it on, it is as if it had never been switched on before? Why can't it come on instantly, like the radio or stereo system, and just do its business? Why does it have to check its innards and announce everyone who had ever had a copyright interest in it? Why, above all, when I try to switch it off, does it put a little window that says, are you sure you want to switch off? Why do we foot a bill rather than, say, head it? Why do we say that we are head over heels about something when our head normally is over our heels? Why can you show up, can you slow up and not speed down? Why do we say that something that is in rapid motion is moving fast, but something that is not moving at all is stuck fast? Why do we say our nose is running? Mine slides. How is it that we live in a world in which we can measure the farthest stars, travel at twice the speed of sound, and probe the ocean's depths, and yet they still can't make a pencil sharpener that isn't completely useless? Finally, and above all, why would anyone in a free society choose to become a dentist? Okay. Well, there's a lot of questions with some of us may share. Thank you, Bill Bryson. Well, let's stay in this collection of Bill Bryson columns and go on with this one. He called it Approach with Caution. So sue me. I have a friend in Britain, an academic, who was recently approached by the lawyers for an American company to be an expert witness in a case they were handling. They told him they wanted to fly the lead attorney and two assistants to London to meet him. Wouldn't it be simpler and cheaper if I flew to New York instead? My friend suggested. Yes, he was told without hesitation, but this way we can bill a client for the cost of three trips. And there you have the American legal mind at work. Now I have no doubt that the largest number of American lawyers, well, two anyway, do wonderfully worthwhile things that fully justify charging their clients $150 an hour, which I gather is the going rate now. But trouble is if there are just too many of them. In fact, and here is the truly sobering statistic, the United States has more lawyers than all of the rest of the world put together. Almost 800,000 of them, up from already an abundant 260,000 in 1960. We now boast 300 lawyers for every 100,000 citizens. Britain, by contrast, has 82. Japan, a mere 11. And we have, I'll reiterate, 300 lawyers for every 100,000 citizens. And of course, all those lawyers need work. Most states allow lawyers to advertise, and many of them do enthusiastically. You cannot watch TV for half an hour without encountering at least one commercial showing a sincere-looking lawyer saying, "Hi, I'm Vinny Slick of Bent and Oily Law Associates. If you have suffered an injury at work or been in a vehicular accident or just feel like having some extra money, come see me and we'll find someone to sue." That doesn't sound too outrageous, though. I'm afraid much of it is true. Americans, as is well known, will sue at the top of a hat. In fact, I dare say someone somewhere has sued over a dropped hat and won $20 million for the pain and suffering it caused. There really is a sense if something goes wrong for whatever reason and you are anywhere in the vicinity, then you ought to collect a pile of cash. This was neatly illustrated a couple of years ago when a chemical plant in Richmond, California, suffered an explosion that spewed fumes over the town. Within hours, some 200 lawyers and their representatives had descended on the excited community, handing out business cards and advising people to present themselves at a local hospital. 20,000 residents easily and eagerly did so. News footage of the event makes it look like some kind of open-air party of the 20,000 happy, smiling, seemingly very healthy people who lined up for examinations at the hospital's emergency room. Just 20 were actually admitted. Although the number of proven injuries was slight, to say the least, 70,000 people, virtually all of them, submitted claims. The company agreed to a $180 million settlement. Of this, the lawyers got $40 million. Every year, over 90 million lawsuits are filed in this extravagantly litigious country. That's one for every 2.5 people. And many of those are what might charitably be called ambitious. As I write now, two parents in Texas are suing a high school baseball coach for benching their son during a game, claiming humiliation and extreme mental anguish. In Washington State, meanwhile, a man with heart problems is suing local dairies because their milk cartons did not warn them about cholesterol. I'm sure you read recently about the woman in California who sued the Walt Disney Company after she and her family were mugged in a parking lot at Disneyland. A central part of the lawsuit was that her grandchild or grandchildren suffered shock and trauma when they were taken behind the scenes to be comforted, and they saw Disney characters taking off their costumes. The discovery that Mickey Mouse and Goofy were in fact real people inside costumes was apparently too much for the poor tykes. Now, that case was dismissed, but elsewhere people have won fortunes out of proportion to any pain or loss they may actually have suffered. Recently, there was a much publicized case in which an executive at a Milwaukee brewery recounted a racy plot of an episode of Seinfeld to a female colleague who took offense and reported him for sexual harassment. The brewery responded by firing the man, and he responded by suing the brewery. Now, I don't know who deserved what in this case. Sounds to me like they all wanted a good, sound spanking. But the upshot is that the dismissed executive was awarded $26.6 million, roughly 400,000 times his salary, by a sympathetic, that is, demented jury. This sort of thing goes to the highest level. As I write this, the estate of Richard M. Nixon is suing the government for $210 million. Let me just repeat that sum. $210 million to compensate the Nixon family for lost earnings from papers and other documents that the government seized as evidence in the Watergate case. You understand what I'm saying? Of course. President of the United States, after acting with the crassest illegality, is driven from office in disgrace, and 24 years later, his family is asking for $210 million of the nation's money. The day cannot be far off when Bill Clinton will be suing them for mental trauma suffered while having oral sex with, while trying simultaneously to run the nation. That must be worth at least a couple of billion, surely. Allied with the idea that lawsuits are a quick way of gaining a fortune, whether deserved or not, it is interesting and uniquely American that no matter what, someone else must be responsible. So if, say, you smoke 80 cigarettes a day for 50 years and eventually you get cancer, then it must be everyone else's fault but your own. And you sue not only the manufacturer of the cigarettes, but the wholesaler, the retailers, the delivery company, that deliver the cigarettes to the retailer, and so on. One of the most extraordinary features of the American legal system is that it allows plaintiffs to sue people and enterprises only tangentially connected to the alleged complaint. because of the way the system works, or more accurately, doesn't work, is often less expensive for a company or institution to settle out of court than to let the matter proceed to trial. I know a woman who slipped and fell while entering a department store on a rainy day and, to her astonishment and gratification, was offered a more or less instant settlement of $2,500 if she would sign a piece of paper agreeing not to sue. She signed. The cost of all this to society is enormous. Several billion dollars a year, at least. New York City alone spends $200 million a year settling, quote, slip and fall claims, people tripping over curbs and the like. According to a recent ABC television documentary on America's runaway legal system, because of inflated product liability costs, the United States pays $500 more than they need to for every car they buy, $100 for football helmets, and $3,000 more for heart pacemakers. According to the documentary, they even pay a little on top, as it were, for haircuts because one or two distressed customers successfully sued their barbers. After being given the sort of embarrassing trims that I receive as a matter of routine, all of which naturally has given me an idea. I think I'm going to go and smoke 80 cigarettes, then slip and fall while drinking high cholesterol milk and relating the plot of a Seinfeld show to a passing female in the Disneyland parking lot, and then I'll call Vinny Slick and see if we can't strike a deal. I don't expect to settle for less than $2.5 billion. That's before we've even started talking about my latest haircut. Okay, interesting thoughts from Bill Bryson. Okay, I now have picked up the collection of columns by Irma Bombeck, and I'll share with you this one that she called Burning Calories. She wrote it August 18th, 1974. My doctor flipped the weight off the scale over another one more notch, looked at me with annoyance and said, "Man does not live by bread alone." "You think I don't know that?" I said. "Any fool knows you have to make it into a sandwich, top it with homemade preserves, or cover it with cheese and sauce, and make a casserole of it." "You are overweight again," he said. "Like how much?" "Like if you were scheduled to fight Muhammad Ali this fall, you would have to drop 15 pounds to make the heavyweight division." "How much exercise do you get?" I leaned over a week ago, Thursday, for what I thought was a ginger snap cookie in the carpet, but it turned out to be a cork coaster, and I haven't taken the chance since. "Do you go to the refrigerator a lot?" "Yes, and sometimes I even run." I have here a list of activities that tell you how many calories you can burn in 1 hour. I want you to go over the list and try to do at least one or two activities a day." The list was depressing. An hour of housework burnt up 80 to 180 calories, ironing 50 to 60, and writing 10 to 20. I would have to arm wrestle King Kong to make a difference. Then a brilliant idea hit me. If I could do some vigorous exercises, I could eat all the food I wanted and burn it off before it took root. That night, I had a piece of apple pie. Then I grabbed one of the kids' bicycles and pedaled for 2 hours. It was work, but it was worth it. I had paid for my folly. The next night, I had 40 potato chips. To make up for it, I did a little ironing that I had put back. Actually, I only ironed for 8 hours, put the rest of it back again. The next afternoon, I outdid myself. I found an Easter egg I had hidden from the kids in the freezer, totaling 583 calories. I had to paint the house to work it off. The same night, I had lobster in butter, which totaled 2,390 calories. Checking my list, I discovered I would have to row across Lake Erie and back to balance the calories. Then a terrible pattern began to form. I was borrowing on my energy and putting IOUs in the refrigerator. I owed 2 hours of carpentry for a bowl of cereal and cream, 3 miles of jogging for a French donut, and 8 days of shoveling snow for a piece of birthday cake. As I sit here writing this column, I am in hock through 1975. Remember, she wrote this in April of 1974. I'm in hock through 1975. As I told my doctor, the only way I can possibly catch up is to be an oarsman on a slave ship. He's making the necessary arrangements now. Okay, thank you, Irma. Okay, I think we're going to go to the end of the show with this list of someone titled Football Isms. I may have read this one before to you, but I don't recall for certain. But I looked them over again, and they're pretty funny. Remember, football isms. Quote, gentlemen, it is better to have died as a small boy than to fumble the football. John Heisman. I make my practices real hard because if a player is a quitter, I want him to quit in practice, not in the game. Bear Bryant of Alabama. It isn't necessary to see good tackles. You can hear it. Newt Rockne from Notre Dame. The man who complains about the way the ball bounces is likely to be the one who dropped it. Lou Holtz, Arkansas and Notre Dame. When you win, nothing hurts. Joe Namath from Alabama. A school without football is in danger of deteriorating into a medieval study hall. From Frank Leahy, Notre Dame. There's nothing that cleanses your soul like getting the hell kicked out of you. Woody Hayes from Ohio State. You know what? I think we're going to have to close it down because I'm afraid of running out of time, and I've done that too often. I hope you enjoyed today's readings, and I hope you can be back with me the next time I do a lighter side. Again, this is The Lighter Side. I'm Jerry Podgorski, and until we meet again, please stay safe and be careful. Bye now.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Hi, this is Valerie Goldston. And now I'll be reading some of the latest stories from National Geographic magazine. Here's our next story, Into the Kingdom of Seahorses. Words by Lindsay Leal. Heather Mason was used to her quarry being much more elusive. Seahorses, often only a few inches long, can change colors like a chameleon and rarely gather in groups. Their ability to disappear into their habitats, tropical seagrasses, mangroves, and reefs, helps keep the slow-swimming, largely defenseless fish from becoming an easy meal. That makes devoting a career to studying them, as Mason, a marine ecologist at the University of Tampa, has done for decades, an exercise in patience. But when she first snorkeled the pristine waters of Sweeting's Pond on the Bohemian island of Eleuthera, she found herself in a seahorse-studded heaven. Over her first weekend in the pond's clear blue water in 2013, she counted 16 seahorses, far more than the one or two she'd be lucky to spot during multi-week research trips along the coast of the Bahamas. Immediately, Mason realized that the mile-long Sweeting's Pond was special. It was life-changing, as someone who looks for seahorses in the wild, she says. Mason's life-changing moment can be traced back some 7,000 to 10,000 years. That's when scientists estimate Sweeting's Pond filled with ocean water that filtered in from nearby Hatchet Bay, roughly 1 mile east, through underwater cracks and holes. The landlocked seawater lagoon, in turn, became a fortress for brittle stars, spider crabs, octopuses, bioluminescent plankton, and, of course, the seahorses. A refuge where several of the species' regular predators, skates and rays, tuna, sharks, can't possibly break in. It's an island on an island, explains Mason. Inside Sweeting's Pond, Mason found seahorses as singular as the body of water itself. With oddly long snouts, squat bodies, and short tails, they differed radically from anything she had seen since she'd begun studying the creatures in 1990. She and her collaborator, evolutionary biologist Emily Rose, classified them as lined seahorses, Hippocampus erectus. But the seahorses of Sweeting's are on a path to becoming their own subspecies. Observing so many of them in isolation offers an opportunity to study evolution in action, as Mason puts it. But the biggest breakthrough came in the dark. Botanist Ethan Freed, who works for the Bahamas National Trust, the nonprofit that manages the country's national parks, had originally learned from locals about Sweeting's seahorse population and contacted Mason. After the marine ecologist's initial visit, Freed had an idea. What if they explored the pond at night? Under a starlit sky, Mason and Freed donned scuba gear with dive lights and waded into Sweeting's. They could barely believe their goggled eyes. I ran my light across the bottom, and it was like road reflectors at night, Mason recalls. You could see seahorses lit up everywhere. Freed describes the scene as resembling a seahorse rave. On a later trip, over the course of 4 days and nights, Mason and a research team documented 800 seahorses, roughly five times as many as they'd counted during daylight hours in the same limited area. Some were just a few days old, a surprise as tiny juveniles are rarely seen, and little is known about what happens to newborn seahorses in the wild. Most striking was the difference in the fish's behavior. During the day, the seahorses are face down. They're cryptic. They're hiding, Mason says. And at night, they come up higher in the vegetation, so they're upright and obvious. That nighttime rave, as Freed puts it, doesn't necessarily mean all seahorses are nocturnal. Sweeting's is isolated, and its seahorses' behavior may be unique. Nor does the research team understand why these seahorses spend their days face down, though it's possible they're resting after a night of eating plankton and small crustaceans, or hiding from birds that feed on them in shallow waters. Still, the overnight survey and subsequent research resulted in the first published paper on seahorses' nocturnal lives. In 2003, the team reported that Sweeting's Pond is home to the highest known density of seahorses in the world, a number in the thousands. At the time of the dark of night discoveries, the pond was still open to the public. But Mason's years of research helped the Bahamas National Trust petition the Bahamian government for protection. 2 years ago, Sweetings Pond became part of the newly created Seahorse National Park, a preserve that spans 548 acres and includes Hatchet Bay Cove, one of the largest dry cave systems in the Bahamas. The park closed to the public a few months later, and the trust now raises funds and prioritizes conservation over access. Mason is still plumbing the data she collected over a decade and hopes to return to the pond. Answers to questions about courtship rituals, the reason for male pregnancy, and where seahorse babies go after being born may float in the pond's placid waters. Sweetings might also show how the species responds to rising water temperatures. Before this project, I would have hesitated to ever use this word about a system, but Sweetings Pond is magical, Mason says. There is a sea of questions to answer. For now, the seahorses of Sweetings Pond are safe in their island inside an island and can keep their secrets a little while longer. Up next, the average attention span has shrunk to roughly 40 seconds by Victoria Traverso. Think about the last time you paused what you were doing to check something else, an email, a message, a notification. How far into your original task were you before you switched? For most people, the answer is less than a minute. Over the past two decades, researchers have found that the average time people stay focused on a single task has dropped from about 2.5 minutes to roughly 40 seconds. That erosion of sustained attention is linked to higher stress, more errors, and reduced productivity. But scientists who study attention say the trend is not irreversible. With targeted strategies and training, they've found the brain's capacity to focus can be strengthened again. How do we measure attention? Attention, broadly defined, is the ability to direct the mind on a specific task, says Gloria Mark, author of Attention Span, a groundbreaking way to restore balance, happiness, and productivity. There are two main types of attention, Mark explains. Involuntary attention is automatic. It's what allows us to react to a loud noise or a jarring bright light. Focalized attention, by contrast, is the ability to concentrate on a specific task. This latter type is what scientists measure when researching attention spans. Since the early 2000s, Mark has tracked focalized attention by observing how long people remain on a task before switching to something else, such as checking email or opening a new browser tab. At first, Mark used in-person observations. Researchers shadowed employees throughout the office. In recent years, she has tracked attention spans using software that monitors people's computers. Data from our first study in 2003 revealed that people spent an average of 2.5 minutes on something before turning their attention to a difficult task, she says. Our most recent study, done over the past 5 years, shows that the figure has gone down to 40 seconds. The measure doesn't capture how long people can focus under ideal conditions, Mark notes, meaning shorter attention spans don't reflect a permanent loss of attention capacity, but changes in how often people break their focus in daily life. Is a shorter attention span an issue? Because some tasks take more than 40 seconds to complete, rapid attention switching often means people move on before finishing what they set out to do. Think of leaving a news story midway through to check your email and then going back to the story. That back and forth may feel harmless, but it creates extra work for the brain, explains Mark. That's because each time we set out to do something, whether writing an email or checking train times, our minds bring up a schema to sort through the information needed for that task. When attention shifts to something else, our mind puts down that schema and quickly comes up with a new one. This requires effort and depletes our limited cognitive resources. Frequent switching can also leave behind what Mark calls attention residues. Think of it as a whiteboard, Mark says. Sometimes we erase something on it, but some of the ink remains and stays as a trace in the background. Those mental remnants linger in the background, competing with the demands of the next task, the cognitive equivalent of having too many tabs open. Experimental evidence supports this picture. A 2024 laboratory study found that switching between tasks reliably slows performance and increases error, even under tightly controlled conditions designed to isolate attention mechanisms, reinforcing the idea that multitasking carries inherent cognitive costs. The myth of multitasking. It's easy to assume that rapidly switching between tasks enables multitasking, but from a cognitive perspective, that's not possible. Our ability to focus can be directed to only one thing at a time, says Amishi Jha, a psychology professor at the University of Miami and author of Peak Mind, Find Your Focus, Own Your Attention, Invest 12 Minutes a Day. The ability to pay attention developed out of an evolutionary need to prioritize information, explains Jha. Because the brain cannot process everything it encounters, it operates more like a spotlight, illuminating one stream of information while leaving the rest in the background. We only have one flashlight, Jha says, so we can't point it to multiple things at once. What people often describe as multitasking is, in fact, rapid task switching, shifting attention back and forth between activities. And that is a terrible way to spend our attention resources, Jha says. In some studies, task switching can reduce productivity by up to 40% compared with doing tasks separately. Other research has found that people who report being strong multitaskers often perform worse on object measures of attention control, including filtering out distractions and switching tasks efficiently. How to get your attention back? Juggling multiple projects and responsibilities and working against a backdrop of constant notifications is a non-negotiable part of life for most people. But as experts like Jha and Mark explain, we can protect and replenish our limited attention even against the pressure of modern life. One place to start is timing. Mark suggests planning demanding work around your chronotype, your body's natural rhythms of alertness and fatigue. To find out about your chronotype, keep a journal and write down your daily ebbs and flows of alertness and focus. Once you have this personal attention map, you can plan your most important tasks around your peaks of attention. During those windows, Mark recommends minimizing interruptions by silencing notifications, blocking social media, and reducing other distractions. Just as important as focused work, she adds, are intentional breaks. Taking breaks is especially beneficial if it involves physical activity, Mark says, and ideally if it can be done out in nature. The timing of breaks can vary. In our attention-scarce times, many people find that 25 minutes of uninterrupted work followed by a 5-minute break, also known as the Prodomoro technique, can help make the most of our attentional resources. Attention can also be strengthened directly through training. Jha, who works with people who need to stay focused in high-stress conditions, such as elite athletes and military personnel, has found that 12 minutes of mindfulness practice at least 4 times a week can improve attention, memory, and resilience to stress. Mindfulness works by exercising attention itself, Jha explains. By focusing on our breath, we build our ability to direct our flashlight onto something specific, noticing our mind wandering and gently redirecting it back to our task helps us become more aware of our attention. It improves our ability to focus despite distractions. Over time, that practice can strengthen attention, much like physical exercise strengthens muscles. We all know that daily physical exercise is necessary for our physical health, Yah says. And now we also know that there is something we can do to exercise our mind. Up next, Why Women May Get More Exercise Than Men, by Hannah Singleton. For decades, exercise guidelines have treated men's and women's bodies as essentially the same. But new studies suggest that assumption may be wrong. Emerging evidence shows that women often experience greater reductions in heart disease and early death from physical activity than men. The findings are prompting researchers to reconsider how exercise recommendations are made and whether one-size-fits-all guidance truly reflects how different bodies respond to movement. What does research say about sex-based differences in exercise benefits? Two large studies published in the past 2 years suggest that men and women may experience different health returns from exercise, particularly when it comes to heart disease and overall mortality risk. Together, they point to a consistent pattern. Women appear to gain more protection from physical activity than men do at comparable levels. Both studies use the American Heart Association's physical activity guidelines as a baseline. 150 minutes of moderate intensity exercise, or 75 minutes of vigorous exercise per week for both sexes. A 2024 study in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, JACC, examined survey data about leisure time physical activity from over 400,000 adults. After tracking nearly 40,000 all-cause deaths during the study period, researchers found that regular physical activity was associated with a 24% lower risk of mortality in women, compared to just 15% in men. Men hit peak mortality benefit at 300 minutes of moderate to vigorous activity per week. Women reached similar benefits with just 140 minutes. When women reached 300 minutes, their risk dropped even further, beyond what men experienced at any level. These results were consistent across both aerobic activity and resistance training. The researchers controlled for confounding factors like age, BMI, alcohol use, smoking, self-reported health, and access to medical care. Cardiologists emphasize that the comparison isn't between men and women, but between people who move and those who don't. It's showing that a woman who exercises compared to a woman who doesn't exercise, the relative benefit appears greater than if you take a man who exercises compared to a man who doesn't exercise, says Carolyn Lamb, a woman's heart health cardiologist and senior consultant at the National Heart Center in Singapore. Was serving as deputy editor at JACC when this paper was published. The comparisons are within sex, not between sex. Most recently, a 2025 study in Nature echoed these findings, using wearable data for more than 85,000 participants in the UK to access coronary heart disease, CHD, incidence. Women who met the 150-minute per week physical activity guideline had a 22% lower risk of CHD compared to 17% for men. As weekly activity increased, the gap widened further. With 250 minutes of weekly movement, women's risk dropped 30%, while men needed 530 minutes to see the same reduction. They also observed lower mortality risk among patients with existing CHD. Taken together, these findings suggest that current exercise guidelines may not fully capture how different bodies respond to physical activity, and that researchers are only beginning to understand why. Scientists also found that women typically underreport exercise compared to men, so they ran a secondary analysis to account for this and found similar results. Why might women benefit more? Researchers don't yet fully understand the mechanisms, but Lamb says cardiologists have a few theories. The mechanisms likely involve multiple systems working in concert, she says. That could include larger boosts of HDL, the good cholesterol, improved blood vessel function, endothelial function, and more efficient metabolic adaptation with each workout. One likely contributor is estrogen. There is data that shows that estrogen, the woman's sex hormone, has some cardioprotective effects, says Lamb. It could amplify the effects of exercise on these adaptations in our blood vessels and the heart. A 2017 literature review explains that estrogen, specifically estradiol or E2, helps protect the heart by improving blood flow and reducing damage. It does this by encouraging the growth of new blood vessels, angiogenesis, increasing blood flow through vasodilation, and lowering harmful byproducts, such as oxidative stress and inflammation, which can damage tissue and organs, including the heart. That said, this doesn't mean women should jump to get on hormone therapy. These are postulations, she emphasizes. And prospective studies haven't proven that hormone replacement therapy provides this benefit. Women's unique exercise benefits may also depend on body size, Lamb says. Women's cardiovascular systems are tuned to be efficient with a smaller heart pump and shorter vascular tree, given that women are, in general, smaller and shorter than men. Still, Lamb emphasizes that there's a lot more that researchers don't know, such as the precise molecular mechanism, how these effects may vary across the lifespan and through menopause, and which types of exercise boost the benefits the most. Why are these studies significant? These findings don't mean that because women benefit from lower levels of exercise than men do, they should be exercising less. Far from it. In fact, they highlight the opportunities that may still be on the table. According to the Centers for Disease Control, only 20% of women meet the recommended 150 minutes a week, compared to 28% of men. While even a small amount of exercise can help reduce mortality risk, women might be missing out on even greater benefits if they increase their weekly activity level above the recommended level. Lamb says that these findings are also significant in a clinical sense. Women with conditions like coronary heart disease are less likely to be referred to cardiac exercise rehab than men. We really do need to make a strong message that women benefit from exercise too, she says. This kind of research also builds the case for more nuanced, sex-specific exercise recommendations. Right now, the physical activity guidelines are one size fits all, but men might need a higher dose than the minimum to achieve the same results. It's been remarkable that in less than 60 years, we've gone from exercise will harm you to discovering that women's cardiovascular systems may be exquisitely responsive to exercise, Lamb says. But we're really at the beginning of understanding women's exercise physiology as its own field, not just as a footnote to male physiology. Here's our next story. Cemetery cafes are trending in Berlin by Christy Dietz and Sam Kemp. It's said that life is a dance with death. But what about sitting down for a coffee with the Grim Reaper? Enter the Cemetery Cafe, offering patrons the rare opportunity to sip flat whites in the company of the dearly departed. These surprisingly cozy spots have been cropping up across Berlin with increasing frequency. You'd be forgiven for assuming this particular trend is the product of some Teutonic appetite for the macabre. But cemetery cafes are as much about life as they are death. Unlike, say, New York, where the dead were historically buried on the city's outskirts, Berlin is threaded with cemeteries, each a small, peaceful sanctuary. The knock-on effect is they've become hubs for the communities they serve. Berlin's first cemetery cafe was founded in the leafy district of Schoenberg by actor and gay rights activist Bernard Bosman. Many of his friends who died during the AIDS epidemic are buried at Old St. Matthaus Churchyard, where folklorists the Brothers Grimm were laid to rest a century previously. Bosman decided it should be a more appealing place for the living, too. His solution? Café Finovo, a purveyor of coffee, cake, and flowers, set in what was once the groundkeeper's cottage. Opened in 2006, it's adorned with mementos donated by relatives of those buried outside. Since then, around a dozen such spaces have opened in the city. Café Friedberg is one of two to open last year. All high vaulted ceilings and arched windows, it occupies the 19th century Kreuzberg funeral parlor, in which its customers' ancestors were quite possibly laid out. In good weather, the graveside patio is filled with locals sipping matcha. Overlooking Gorgon Parochial Cemetery, Nona Cafe and Company occupies a former florist and draws a young crowd with the promise of natural wine tasting and Czech pastries. In neighboring Mitte, meanwhile, Bistro Lisbeth brings Italian flair to its cemetery setting. Pop your head into its bulb-strung garden, and you're likely to find friends reading tarot cards alongside mourners toasting a departed relative over Prosecco and slow-roasted prosciutto. Italy, a necropolis of lavish tombs, Venice's main burial ground, San Michele Cemetery, fills its namesake island. Catch a water bus across the lagoon to admire the 15th century church, or visit during the week around All Saints' Day, November 1st, and trot across via a floating bridge. Austria. The Wiener Zentralfriedhof in Vienna is famous for its grand mausoleum and as the final resting place of Beethoven and Brahms. It's also renowned for its tiny guests. Keep an eye out for endangered European hamsters foraging between the graves. Romania. Mary Cemetery, in the village of Sapanta, is home to about 700 oak crosses, decorated with darkly humorous poems and illustrations. One features a skeleton dragging down an unfortunate soul. My name is Valerie Goldston. This has been brought to you by the Mind's Eye Organization.
Hello, and welcome to show number 2609 of Eyes on Success, a weekly program empowering the visually impaired with expert advice, personal stories, and the latest in technology and accessibility. I'm Nancy Goodman-Torpy.
And I'm Pete Torpy.
Quality is not a luxury. It's part of access. And I think about how often our blind audiences are put in the position of choosing, do you want more or do you want it better? As if that's the choice. And sighted people aren't put in that position. So what I've been doing is training performers to serve the story and not their ego.
And I'm sure many of us appreciate having quality audio descriptions.
Audio description brings performances to life for blind audiences by turning visuals into clear narration. We'll talk with Roy Samuelson about writing and performing descriptions that match on-screen action, carry the emotion of the scenes, and make the experience overall more enjoyable. He also teaches and advises other people on how to do audio description well, expanding the availability of good quality audio descriptions. But first, for our tip of the week, this week's tip comes from Roy Samuelson.
The tip of the week is when performing, when you've got words to say to someone else, to think about what your intention is behind those words.
Then he proceeded to show us what he meant with an example.
Could we do a living example right now with the three of us?
Sure.
Could you give me a neutral sentence just off the top of your head?
We like to hike around the Mesa.
If I were to say, who likes to hike around the Mesa? How would you answer me using those exact words? Who likes to hike around the Mesa?
We like to hike around the Mesa.
Do you like to run around the Mesa?
We like to hike around the Mesa.
Do you like to run around the block?
We like to hike around the Mesa.
Gotcha. So simply by giving a question, you put different emphasis on three different words. Just by prompting, the context of answering a question can change the meaning of a sentence.
Then he extended the lesson.
I'd love to do one more if I'm not pushing my luck.
Go ahead.
Great. So that same sentence, we like to hike around the Mesa. If I were to say to you, could you share that sentence with me with the intent to discover? What would that sound like?
I don't know.
Could I give you a prompt like, oh, if you started the sentence, we like to hike around the Mesa by starting by saying, oh, what would that sound like?
Oh, we like to walk around the Mesa.
Yeah. And if I were to say, could you say that same sentence, we like to hike around the Mesa as a threat to someone? Like if you were to think about, I'm going to threaten someone, like furrow your brows and point a finger and kind of put them in their place by using those words, we like to hike around the Mesa, almost like you're defending yourself. What would that sound like?
We like to hike around the Mesa.
Yeah, there's a little attitude in there. I could hear that little, there's a little bit of gravel and kind of protective defense. And then if you were to say to someone that you really care about deeply, that you love, and you were to say, I really like you a lot, like literally say the words, I really like you a lot. We like to hike around the Mesa. What would that sound like?
I really like you a lot. We like to hike around the Mesa.
So adding those extra words at the beginning, along with the intent, whether it's to discover by adding that word O to the beginning, or to threaten by physically pointing a finger at someone and saying, I'm going to put you in your place, or to love and to find that affection, we're able to change the intent of what that very sentence means. And then when you apply the other context of emphasizing certain words, but instead of focusing on emphasizing certain words, what we're doing is giving context to it. So you're using the same sentence to answer different questions. That's what we do.
We got a good lesson in audio description there, I think. You must be a good teacher. I'm impressed. Those were excellent examples.
I appreciate you indulging me. This was a lot of fun.
Support for Eyes on Success is provided by
the My Tools for Living retail store at the Chicago Lighthouse, offering tools and technologies to support everyday life across the vision loss spectrum, as well as ongoing advice. More information is available at mytoolsforliving.com.
You are listening to Eyes on Success. 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 Success.
Let's start by meeting Roy.
Hi, it's Roy Samuelson, and I ensure that audio description is part of the story so blind audiences can stay immersed instead of pulled out.
And you are an audio describer and have been an audio describer for some time, I take it.
Yeah, I like to call myself an audio description performer as well as an audio description producer. And that term describer can get a little tricky because there's so many elements to how audio description is created for film and TV. So I spent over a decade performing and producing audio description for film and TV.
And you do mostly film and TV, not live productions?
Yeah, that's a really good distinction. The work that I do is primarily pre-recorded content.
Before we get into some of the details of how your art is done, tell us how you got into this field.
Oh, that's a great question. I started off as a voice actor, and there was an opportunity to audition for a film that was creating audio description. And I remember going into this, Pete, where it was so satisfying to see so many elements of what I do in voiceover in this one genre that I had never heard of. I didn't get any sleep that night because I was so excited of the experience. And that was probably about 10 or 12 years ago. And each time that I've gone in to record, either at my studio or at someone else's studio, there's something about what good AD feels like to listen to that I really like to light into.
And when you say AD, you mean audio description.
Yes, nice catch, because there's so many different meanings of AD, even in film and TV. There's the assistant director, or you think about advertisements AD. So I'm really glad you said that. Yeah, it's audio description.
Had you ever had any experience with blind people before you got into the field?
That's a great question. Oh, my goodness, Nancy. I had some very limited experiences. But because of the work that I do, a lot of blind people have reached out and I've reached out, and we've developed some pretty strong friendships. And also around the same time that I started working in audio description, one of my dearest friends, a chosen family friend, we were so close and so connected. And he was a writer for television. And so he would always complain about all these things that are happening in a TV series. And it was so funny. And we really connected a lot. Towards the end of his life, he ended up losing all of his sight during some treatments. And what was so incredible about audio description in this context was I was able to be with him talking about a TV show without those gaps. That because audio description was giving him the access to the visuals, we could still have the same conversation about a TV show and all the great moments that happened, where he would say, oh, did you see that part where such and such happened? Oh, I can't believe they did that. And there were no speed bumps in the conversation. And that is yet another form of access that I literally got to experience. That was really the driving force.
You've been doing this for some time now, and you're presumably quite skilled at it. But I'm curious how you developed the skills to do audio description in a quality way. What kind of training is involved, or life experiences?
There's a combination of training and life experiences that with the work that I do in voiceover in general as a voiceover performer, there's all sorts of different things. And I won't get into the weeds, but it's basically bringing a script to life. And I feel very passionately about how there's so many different approaches to that, but with the intent of bringing the words to life for our audience that is participating in audio description, that means that that immersive experience is there in parity to sighted audiences. That if a sighted audience is gasping or laughing or crying or holding their heart in shock, if our blind audience isn't having that same experience, then the audio description isn't serving them. And that's a combination of the writing quality of the audio description, and it's also how that writing is brought to life. And that bringing to life is what I like to focus on.
And you presumably do your own writing and talking when you're creating audio description, right?
When I'm producing, I outsource both. So I like to hire blind professionals, both as writers and voice talents. We can go into some of that, but most of my experience has been performing scripts that have already been written for me. I have done writing for audio description, but my main focus has been bringing those scripts to life that are already written and why that matters. On the producing side, it does make a difference to be able to make sure that we're bringing the best writers and the best performers and the best engineers, the best people that can know when to place things, and how that mix, how that turning the volume up and down is reduced as much as possible so that our blind audiences don't have to keep fiddling with the volume.
Yeah. So some people, like Pete's been blind all his life, and I usually do a very informal description when we're watching things together, and he wants it as terse as possible. But some people who are new to being blind want it as descriptive as possible. How do you strike a balance between those two extremes?
I love this question. We were just talking about this in the spectrum of blindness, that there are some people that, regardless of being born blind or having progressive blindness like RP or even different kinds of blindness, that each person has their own quality wish of what that audio description can look like. Some people really care about the set and the design and the spectacle. Other people are really focused on the emotional expressions. Other people want to know the costumes. And other people, it sounds like Pete, is just like, give me the bare bones. And what I think is so fascinating about what is happening now in the industry is that those kinds of choices are just starting to peek out. In other words, I have an idealistic vision of someone turning on a TV show or a film and being able to choose from multiple different levels of audio description to be able to accommodate a more almost wall-to-wall describing as much as possible in between lines of dialogue to something that's a lot more reserved and just gives the bare bones. And that our audiences should be able to choose that. And I think the technology is allowing us to get there.
A number of years ago, we actually did a show interviewing some people in a museum and how accessible it was. And I thought it was interesting. They actually had two different audio descriptions that people could tune into. One was a very descriptive narration of what the picture was about. There's a woman carrying a yellow rose and in a pink dress and this kind of a hat and what's behind her and the smoke and all that. And then the other one was, this is a scene from an 18th century commercial coal town. You know, one gives you kind of the overall impression and one gives you a lot of details. And as you say, people like different descriptions depending on who they are and their background.
It's a great point. And thinking about museum, that freedom that museum has in two levels. First of all, being able to choose to have two different versions of audio description, but also the level of timing that in pre-recorded media like film and TV, in most cases, we're limited to finding places to put the audio description in between lines of dialogue. And the old expression of a picture is worth 1,000 words, you take that to 24 frames per second of film, that's 24,000 words to choose from for every second. And it really helps me respect the writers who create the audio description, but also the freedom, like you said, with that museum to be able to have, you know, maybe a longer track to be able to really go into the detail for someone that wants that. And then for someone else, it's like, okay, I got what I needed. Let's move on.
Well, it's interesting, as you point out, I'm always amazed you guys so artfully insert your comments between the other dialogue and what's going on in the movie or whatever event you're watching. That's tricky.
I love that you said artfully. There is such a impact of the immersive experience that can happen when those decisions are made to make that art, that craft. And I think about how audio description is performed and produced, that we've got all sorts of choices that can be made. I like to talk about the context of what's happening right before or right after. I like to talk about intent. Like, what is the reason that this particular scene is being described and why? When a audio description sounds off, it breaks that immersion. Could I give an example? So you think about, let's say, a horror film where someone's running into the pit of hell away from a demon. And it's like, if you heard a voice that said, he runs into the pit of hell, he dies. That's a very conversational tone. But there's something that's kind of funny about it, like maybe literally funny, but it's definitely off-putting. And in that same scene, if someone were to say, he runs into the pit of hell, he dies, that there's a suspense that can come from that performance that wasn't there in the beginning. And it's the same words, but there's something else that's happening. And that something else, I believe, is where those choices that an audio description performer makes really makes a difference.
That's an interesting point you made. I was thinking as we started the interview that there's a difference between narrating an audiobook where the narrator tries to put their voice into the emotion of what's going on in the novel, whereas someone like yourself doing an audio description, it's a little bit more remote. You're the narrator. And you don't necessarily get into the voice of what's going on. But in the case you just gave, that's very important.
With audio description, we really are surfing the emotional intent of a scene. And within one scene, there could be five or six different intent that happens. And it's up to us to make sure that we are staying true to what is being presented in that scene. And that's part of the work, I believe, to be able to recognize the scene is kind of going dark and we want our audiences to be aware of it. And again, because of that limitation of time and concise words, it really does make a difference to be able not only to make sure that the words are there, but the intent behind how we say the words are there. And I like to call that surfing the emotion, that it's not less of a performance. It's a very nuanced performance. And it really does make a difference, the choices that the actors make.
Well, that example you gave about the poor guy entering the pit of hell, you know, it's really, I think, important, as you just demonstrated, that the audio description stay consistent with the emotion of what's going on.
When you say consistent with the emotion, I think that is the key.
So Nancy mentioned earlier how I often prefer more terse descriptions. Being blind all my life, I'm used to gathering a lot of information through my other senses and interpreting what I hear. So I rely a lot, for example, on the Foley mixer and the soundtrack in the background, portraying a lot of the emotion and the intent of what's going on in the scene. And I wonder, we talked about not stepping on the verbal part of the production. What do you think about stepping on some of those other pieces, the Foley mixing, the sound effects, the musical background and stuff? Is that a concern too?
Absolutely. And I think the way you phrased it is really good. If it is stepping on, then it's getting in the way. And our job is to get out of the way. I try my best when there's a song playing, if I have the space, which is pretty rare, to be able to jump in and out so that I'm in dance with the lyrics. It's hard to listen to two voices at the same time. And that kind of stepping on can really get in the way. So there's a lot of relativity. There's a lot of circumstance that can make a difference. But I think how you phrased it, Pete, that if something feels like it's stepping on, unless it's absolutely essential, that's probably something for the audio description to stay away from and allow the story to be told as it originally was without us adding anything.
The other thing I found in some audio descriptions is there may be a lot of loud music and dancing and stuff going on the screen or the stage that I'd really like to know what's happening, but how do you get over the loudness of that?
This is happening outside of audio description too, that a lot of people, depending on how their home stereo system is set up or their home 5.1 or their home Dolby Atmos or their headset or they're watching on a phone or, you know, the options of how the viewer, whether they're blind or sighted, receives the story can vary. And what's really interesting is that those choices of the engineer really make a difference. And if you're experiencing a really loud audio description during a very intimate moment, that's going to be jarring. And if it's turned down too low during a loud moment, that's going to be jarring too. When I talk to sound engineers, there's certain ways that they can allow the audio description to cut through without making everything the same. As tempting as it is to make everything the same volume level, that can create problems. But we're also within a realm of not too much and not too little. It's that sweet spot. Our work in audio description is that high wire act, whether it's the sound mix, whether it's the timing, whether it's the writing, whether it's the performance, or even the quality control, that all of these elements need to be really solid. And the weakest link in any of them is going to damage the experience.
So do you work in conjunction with the production managers and they might duck certain parts of the audio in back of you to make your descriptions cut through?
That is one option. And if that is chosen deliberately and not leveled across the entire content, that can really work. And there's ways to duck that isn't just turning down the volume altogether.
You've been sounding during our conversation very sincere in your desire to make quality audio descriptions, but I understand that you've taken that to the next level, and you actually are involved in doing advocacy to make sure that a quality audio description experience is available to people who need it. Can you talk about that a little?
Quality is not a luxury. It's part of access. And I think about how often our blind audiences are put in the position of choosing, do you want more or do you want it better? As if that's the choice. And sighted people aren't put in that position. So what I've been doing is training performers to serve the story and not their ego. I recognized that this was the whole point of all storytelling, that it is the focus on the story. And us performers, when we serve the story, it makes a difference. And it's actually in alignment with storytelling in such a beautiful way. So I do advise teams on how the human voice and the choices that that human voice makes can really affect not only trust, but also enjoyment. And so my goal is to, like I said, to make sure that blind audiences get that same emotional experience that everyone else gets. That is yet a form of advocacy. And as I teach more voice actors to do this, whether they're blind or sighted, there's something about making sure that that baseline is where we start from and we can grow into, that we're not just checking the box and saying, okay, we did it, that's enough. But it's really, here's the baseline and here's how far we can take this.
So you do a fair amount of teaching and coaching and guiding. If somebody was interested in getting involved, how would they get started?
I have written a book called A Voice Actor's Guide to Audio Description Performance, and I have shared some experiences and also some quotes from blind audiences and blind professionals from my podcast within the book that talk about all sorts of aspects. And it's really written for all people. I've really done my best to make sure that that book illustrates not only audio description, but also some other applications beyond that. I started a membership that is allowing people to play with audio description scripts. And the idea is to create this really safe place to play and explore. And so this membership, the AD Playback Lounge, the Audio Description Playback Lounge, is a space for that exploration. And it's been fascinating to watch how voice actors of all kinds are growing, not only in audio description performance, but in other areas of voiceover, too.
So if somebody wanted to listen to your podcast or read your book, where would they find those?
Thanks for asking. The book is at roysamuelson.com/book. And the audiobook has actual quotes from the podcast. It's available on Bard for blind audiences as the audio description, A Voice Actor's Guide to Audio Description. And it's also available on Kindle, Audible, and Barnes & Noble and a few other places. It's all at roysamuelson.com/book. And then for the podcast, it's the ADNA Presents. The Audio Description Network Alliance presents, the ADNA presents, and we've got over 250 interviews with professionals of all kinds in audio description and also some outside of audio description that relates to audio description to hear how innovation is happening and how kind of peeling back behind the scenes to hear how different professionals are bringing this work to life.
And if people wanted to connect with you about training opportunities or just ask questions, is there a way they can do that?
Yeah. My email address, which I'm happy to share with you, is roy@roysamuelson.com. And I also come out with a weekly newsletter. And if you go to roysamuelson.kit.com, that's K-I-T in the middle, roysamuelson.kit.com. It's a free newsletter, and I always like to give some tips and tricks of the trade to let people know what's going on and also share any workshops that might be coming up.
Well, thank you so much. And I gather you've done audio description for some pretty well-known events. If somebody wants to listen to you doing that, can you recommend a couple of events that they can go back and listen to?
Oh, sure. Thank you for asking. I'm on a few different streaming services and feature films. The Marty Supreme came out last Christmas of 2025, and it's quite the adventure of a ping pong player, believe it or not. There's also a TV show called Poker Face, and that is a series kind of like Matlock back in the day, but it's tremendously satisfying and fun. Those two come to mind. And also, I'd love to share The Last of Us. What's notable about that TV series is that on the second season, we were able to advocate to make sure our blind quality control person was named in the credits. It's remarkable that HBO was amenable to that. We had worked a while to make sure that would happen. And so it's exciting to have Serena Gilbert celebrated for her work as quality control on that series.
As usual, if you missed anything in the audio, you can find it all in the show notes with the episode. And this episode is number 2609.
That's it for this week's show. Next week on Eyes on Success, we'll be talking about yoga. Yoga can be accessible for everyone when taught with clear descriptions and flexible options. We'll talk with visually impaired yoga instructor Ali Slaughter about guiding gentle classes, adapting poses for different bodies and abilities, supporting students of all abilities, and building community through in-person or virtual yoga classes.
You've been listening to Eyes on Success, available wherever you get your podcasts.
For show notes, resources, and more information, visit our website at eyesonsuccess.net.
Thank you for being part of our community. Until next time, I'm Peter Torpy.
And I'm Nancy Goodman Torpy. Thank you for listening.
Welcome. This is Rebecca Shore for Radio Eye, and today I will be reading the Smithsonian Magazine, dated January-February 2026. As a reminder, Radio Eye is a reading service intended for people who are blind or have other disabilities that make it difficult to read printed material. Please join me now for the first article titled, Nepal's Mountainside Tea Houses Elevate the Experience for Trekkers Heading to the Top of the World. Comforting rest stops dot the trail for adventurers ascending Mira Peak, offering food, rest, and a warm cup of the local brew. By Aaron Treib. We were only 3 days into a 27-day journey through the forests of eastern Nepal, pushing through low clouds and a steady downpour. "Are we going the right way?" I asked Arjun Rai, my guide on the Mira Peak trekking trail. "I think so," he said, rain dripping from the bill of his baseball cap. "I'm pretty sure." The mist was so dense we could barely see 100 feet ahead. It was an especially wet September, the end of monsoon season. As we descended a narrow, muddy gulch, we reached a rushing waterfall that cascaded down a rocky incline and directly blocked our path. To cross it, we slipped off our shoes and socks and waded barefoot through the icy torrent, which dropped off sharply to our right. Rai crossed with ease and grace, lightly gliding from one slick river stone to the next. I clumsily grabbed onto rocks in the water to hold my balance, trying not to scrape my feet or tumble down the waterfall to my death. After we made our way to the other side, Rai lit a cigarette and said, "Now this is a real adventure." We looked at each other through the downpour and both threw our heads back in laughter, briefly forgetting that we were drenched, cold, and covered with mud. That positive outlook is the way of the Nepalis, and especially the native Nepalis of the mountains. When things get hard, which in the Himalayas is most of the time, you make the best of it and keep walking. Still, only about 7% of Nepal's population lives in these high-altitude regions. Life in the Solukhumbu district, home to many of the country's tallest peaks, including Everest, is harsh and often unforgiving. Freezing temperatures, steep cliffs, infertile soil, and few drivable roads. Yet its remoteness and rugged beauty are exactly what draws tourists here. Between October 2023 and September 2024, around 56,000 tourists visited Solukhumbu, most of them foreigners. After 5 hours of trudging through the rain, we finally saw it, a small hut on a hillside, smoke curling from its entrance. A tea house. Reaching the doorway, I ducked beneath a low beam and found Pembadama Sherpa, 14, and her sister, Mi'kma'kanchi, 7, tending the fire. Pembadama smiled shyly as she stirred a pot of pocha, or Sherpa tea. In this region, the thick, salty brew is made of dzomo, a yak and cow hybrid butter, black tea, and roasted barley flour. As the rain drummed against the tin roof, she worked the churn, stirring the tea with a wooden dowel, her movements steady and practiced. Some tea houses are operated by the wives of mountain guides who spend months away leading expeditions. Many others are family-run, some passed down through generations. For many women and families, the tea house is more than a business. It's a vital source of stability. It keeps families, many named for the Sherpa ethnic group, rooted in their ancestral villages, financially provides for their children's education, and creates a steady income in places where few other opportunities exist. The tea house in the next village, Ramilo Danda, belongs to Pertemba Sherpa, a retired mountain guide. My father built this place himself, his son and lodge manager, Changba Sherpa, told me. It was jungle before. He cut the hillside by hand to make flat ground. At first it was very small, only enough space for 6 people. Every year he added a little more, stone by stone. Pertemba started guiding when he was around 20. He tried to summit Everest 5 times and made it twice. When he retired, he turned his focus to the tea house, work that was no easier. The hardest thing, Pertemba said, was water. There's no natural source here. We tried pipes from 3,000 meters, about 2 miles, up the valley, but it didn't work. Finally, we brought water from 450 meters, about 1,500 feet, below, pumping it through the rock. He paused, then smiled. Now it works, mostly. Pertemba also owns another tea house farther up the trail in Chatra Kola, the Mira Riverside Lodge, perched on the edge of a bluff beside a roaring river and a waterfall that feeds the valley below. There, a young woman named Rachana Rai worked in the kitchen, stirring pots of lentils and kneading dough. I like it here, she told me. It's quiet, but not lonely. The mountains keep me company. Every major trek in Solukhumbu begins with a flight into Lukla, a small town perched on a cliff with the runway so short and steep it's considered one of the most dangerous in the world. From there, trails wind northeast toward Everest Base Camp, some 64 miles away on foot, or east for 40 miles toward Mira Peak, 21,247 feet. At Mira's high camp, approximately 19,000 feet, stands what is said to be the highest tea house in Nepal. Surrounded by icefall, cornices, and jagged seracs, it's run by Sherpa cooks who live there for weeks at a time in sub-freezing cold. We don't make much, maybe 30,000 rupees, about $210, a month, one told me through an interpreter. They rely on tips. Tourists are kind. Even with little salary, we are happy to work. When they smile and say thank you, we feel rich. The Sherpa people, whose name comes from the Tibetan words shar, east, and pa, people, are celebrated for their endurance and grace at altitude. Descended from nomads who migrated south from Tibet, they settled in the Solukhumbu region centuries ago and became the backbone of Himalayan mountaineering. While climbers from around the world seek glory on these peaks, it's the Sherpas who guide climbers, fix the ropes, break trails, carry the loads, and, when necessary, recover the fallen, as they did during my own time on Mira, when a Korean climber died and a Sherpa rescue team found his body and brought him down the mountain. Sherpa culture is steeped in Buddhism. Along the trails, the landscape is marked by mani stones, carved with prayers, mantras, or religious images, and stupas, dome-shaped Buddhist shrines, strings of blue, white, red, green, and yellow prayer flags flutter in the wind. Inside the tea houses, the rhythm of life slows. Fires crackle, tea simmers, and stories are told easily between strangers. For the tea house staff, the work is relentless, cooking, cleaning, stoking fires in the thin air, but most owners I met spoke of pride, not exhaustion. "People come from everywhere," said Lakpa Sherpa, owner of Himalayan Lodge and Cafe in Koti. "We take care of them like family. That is our way." On the final morning of the ascent, we left High Camp at 3 a.m., climbing slowly toward Mira's summit as dawn broke, casting an alpenglow on pristine slopes. Our pace was steady. As I continued my way upward, the sun appeared over the mountaintops, and the full expanse of the Himalayas came into view. Everest to the north, Makalu to the northeast, a sweep of glistening peaks stretching in all directions, and the villages we'd passed through scattered far below. By day 21 of the journey, I'd visited nearly a dozen tea houses, had hundreds of conversations, and sipped countless cups of Sherpa tea. Now, as we headed back to Lukla, it struck me how much this climb had depended on the families who opened their doors along the way and offered warmth in a place defined by cold. In Nepal, the rugged landscape is shaped by mountains, but it's the Nepali people and the tea houses that make moving through it possible. Accompanying this article, did you know? How high can you go before needing serious gear? In Nepal, some mountain peaks are accessible by trekking, but higher altitude apexes require actual climbing. At 21,247 feet, Mira is considered Nepal's highest trekking peak. Ascending its low-grade glacial slopes doesn't require the technical rock or ice climbing that peaks such as Mount Everest at 29,032 feet demand. Next. Miles Davis emerged from Middle America to become the Picasso of jazz and taught us all how to be cool. As we approach the 100th anniversary of the birth of a jazz legend, look back on the staggering impact of his work and its continued relevance. By Ted Scheinman. Miles Dewey Davis III's first memory was a blue-hot flame on the family stove. "I felt fear, real fear," he recalled in his 1989 autobiography. He was also exhilarated. "That blue," he said, "presented an invitation, a challenge. Afterward, I have always believed that my motion had to be forward, away from the heat of that flame." Davis was born to a prosperous middle-class family in Alton, Illinois, on May 26, 1926. The next year, the family moved 20 miles or so down the Mississippi River to East St. Louis, or East Boogie, as it came to be known because of its crackling music scene. Davis's father, Miles Davis Jr., was a dental surgeon. His mother, Cleota Henry Davis, was a violinist and pianist and tried to steer her son toward classical music. But Davis, the second of three children, heard more fire in jazz. He started cornet at 10, got his first trumpet at 13, and met his first girlfriend, Irene Berth, when he was 15 or 16. The Davises didn't approve because she came from the Goose Hill neighborhood with its slaughterhouses and stockyards and its smell of burnt meat and hair, Davis recalled. The two fell in love, and Berth provided crucial encouragement. In 1943, she persuaded Davis to try out for the Blue Devils, a band where he played what he called hot dance music and did his first arranging. The next year, he left for the Juilliard School, and Berth and their first child, Cheryl, soon joined him in New York. Davis was a so-so student at Juilliard, spending nights in the clubs from the village to Harlem, drawn by the flame of bebop, according to his biographer, John Sved. He was keen to meet the two architects of this brash new style, trumpeter Dizzy Gillespie and especially saxophonist Charlie Bird Parker. Davis buttonholed Parker outside the Heat Wave, a club on 145th Street, and by the end of 1945, Davis had dropped out of school and scored a spot in his idol's quintet. He likely recorded more trumpet with Parker than even Gillespie did, and he made substantial contributions to bebop. But he wanted to blaze a path of his own, and did so by bringing an intimate attention to tone and phrasing. I prefer a round sound with no attitude in it, like a round voice with not too much tremolo and not too much bass, Davis said. For further understatement, he sometimes used a partial mute in the bell of his trumpet. At the 1949 sessions, later released as Birth of the Cool, the Miles Davis sound emerged, forthright, eloquent, and plaintive, as if lamenting that this was the closest you could get on trumpet to the human voice. It was urbane, perceptive, always ready but never hurried. In short, to use a word whose full meaning we owe to Davis, it was cool. While Berth and Davis never married, they had three children by 1950. Bills mounted, and Davis's ascent slowed as he served a heroin habit. He kicked dope a few times, suffering days and nights of sweats and chills. In 1954, he got clean in earnest. The next year, Columbia Records signed him and bent its marketing apparatus toward making him a superstar, and Davis formed a breathtakingly versatile quintet that included John Coltrane on tenor sax. And boy, could Davis work a band. As the great critic Stanley Crouch wrote, this historic combo stoked fire as ably as it crooned. In the two sessions released in 1959 as Kind of Blue, Davis introduced unfamiliar melodic scales into jazz, and what might have been an obscure modal experiment instead became the biggest jazz album ever recorded. Davis took the wartime sound of bebop and turned down the volume and heat without sacrificing intensity. He'd made a new and beautiful kind of Cold War art, bringing acoustic jazz to such a point of perfection that when he introduced electric guitars a decade later, many critics, especially Crouch, treated it as the vilest heresy ever. They were wrong. Davis's fusion bands were often brilliant, but so what? Davis trained as a boxer for fitness and for protection. He was obsessed with Jack Johnson and Sugar Ray Robinson and imitated them outside the ring, dressing sharp and driving fancy cars. He was legendary for the epithets he delivered in his frying rasp. To say the very least, his relationship with Berth and his three subsequent marriages to Frances Taylor, Betty Mabry, and Cicely Tyson, each an artist in her own right, didn't survive his tempers. The anger was bound up with the prejudice Davis battled all his life. He refused to play segregated shows and was once beaten and arrested for talking back to a white policeman outside a club where his name was on the marquee. He also battled brutal health problems, particularly toward the end. Despite tremendous pain, he maintained a burning curiosity for new music, creating new fusions whenever he played. On September 28, 1991, he ran out of breath. His last studio work, Doobop, a hip-hop-inflected album, released the following year. Today, 100 years after his birth, some folks still resent Davis for being so hard to pin down musically. Many purists hate his 70s music. Why would such a genius debase himself with rock? Many more hate his 80s music. Why was Miles Davis covering Cyndi Lauper? Olu Dara, a cornetist whose son, best known as Nas, became one of the most influential rappers in history, put it this way. Miles was dealing with all that America had to say. He makes you a true American. Accompanying this article, fun fact, what were Miles Davis's nicknames? Davis was known alternately as the Prince of Darkness and the Sorcerer. Both nicknames evoked the trumpeter's mercurial, uncompromising, near-omnipotent approach to music and to life. Next, see the blades that carried Boitano to gold in the Battle of the Bryans in the 1988 Olympics. The Americans' fabled rivalry with Canadian Brian Orser reached its pinnacle in Calgary on these skates, now part of the Smithsonian Collection, by Mike Riggs. On February 20, 1988, millions of people huddled around their televisions to watch the men's figure skating finals at the Winter Olympics in Calgary, Alberta. The French newspaper Le Monde called it La Guerre des Deux Brian, while Spain's El País would remember it as La Batalla de los Brian. Americans and Canadians who lived through this dramatic age of figure skating know it as the Battle of the Brians, in which California's Brian Boitano and Ontario's Brian Orser settled a nearly decade-long rivalry. It was the most watched half hour of American Saturday evening TV since the airing of Roots 11 years earlier. The Olympic podium was an unlikely destination for a kid from Sunnyvale, a suburb of San Francisco. Boitano's father, a banker, wanted him to play baseball. Figure skating was hardly even an option in the town. Sunnyvale's Ice Palace, the neighborhood rink, had never produced a competitive skater of note. While Boitano didn't have access to a posh rink or an elite skating club, he did have obsessive dedication. "I was always the first one on the ice and the last one off," he tells Smithsonian. He also had Linda Lever, a local skating instructor and choreographer, who understood Boitano's potential from the moment she saw him. "By the time Brian was 10, I felt an obligation to his talent and work ethic to make him the best 10-year-old skater in the world," she says. Lever also had a gentle touch with her young charge. "Linda would say just the right thing to get me to relax my shoulders and take a huge sigh of relief," Boitano says. "She knew how to make me feel like everything's going to be okay." That chemistry took Boitano to the 1978 World Junior Figure Skating Championships in France, where, at 14, he earned a bronze medal. At the same competition, 16-year-old Orser finished fourth. The two young men spent the next 9 years orbiting each other in the standings. Orser second and Boitano fifth at the 1984 Winter Olympics, Boitano first and Orser second at the 1986 World Figure Skating Championships, Orser first and Boitano second at the same competition in 1987. That bruising second-place finish at the World Championships stemmed in part from Boitano's fall while attempting to land a tricky quadruple jump. The misstep reinforced his reputation as a performer who relied too much on stunts. He has been known throughout his career as a relentless technician and perfectionist, who perhaps sacrificed artistry for correctness and athletic feats, wrote Sally Jenkins of the Washington Post in 1987. As they stared down the next year's Olympics, Boitano and Lever reassessed their approach. "I was devastated," Boitano says, of his second-place finish in 87. To elevate his program for the subsequent season, he and Lever turned to Sandra Bizik, a Canadian choreographer and a former Olympic skater herself. She created routines that leveraged Boitano's height. At 5'11", he was a larger figure on the ice than most other skaters, including Orser, who was 5'7". The challenge was getting the relatively shy Boitano to act as large as he was. Over the next 9 months, Bizik and Boitano tweaked and perfected his short and long programs. In the former, he played an ostentatiously cocksure skater who wipes the ice from his blades and flings it over his shoulder mid-program. In the latter, he was a Napoleonic soldier, sporting a navy blue uniform with a burgundy sash and gold braid along the shoulders and collar, skating to Carmine Coppola's 1981 score for the re-release of 1927's Napoleon. "I gave him characters that he was able to hide behind, but they were still revealing his true self," Bizik had said. A month before the 88 Olympics, Boitano could skate a clean program without making a mistake. He arrived in Calgary with two pairs of skates, including this custom pair, with boots from Harlequin Company emblazoned with American flag patches with blades from John Wilson Blades, as well as extra laces, and the awareness that Orser had a narrative advantage. "We were on Canadian ice," Boitano says. He carried the flag and had been in second place 4 years before. As predicted, by the final round of the competition, men's figure skating had narrowed to a two-man race between the Bryans. Barring a fiasco, one would win gold and the other silver. Boitano laced up his skates, the blades slightly dulled to keep him from sinking into the ice. Boitano then skated one of the greatest freestyle programs in Olympic history, making one barely perceptible mistake when landing one of his 8 triple jumps. Orser took the ice and performed almost as well, making 2 small mistakes to Boitano's 1. The judges were split, but the rules said that technical merit would break the tie, which is how Brian Boitano, the man with almost too much technique, won the gold at the 1988 Winter Games. Accompanying this article, did you know Brian Boitano was a skating innovator? Brian Boitano invented the Tano Lutz, a.k.a. the Tano Triple, which he introduced in 1980. Boitano jumped off his toe, making it a Lutz jump, then spun 3 times while holding his left hand majestically aloft. Finally, the story of Carthage isn't necessarily what the Romans committed to history. A new book by historian and archaeologist Eve MacDonald paints a more complete portrait of the once great African society destroyed by Rome. By Brandon Tensley. Around 310 BCE, Carthage was under siege by Agathocles of Syracuse and his army. According to the ancient historian Diodorus, Carthaginians began to despair that their gods had forsaken them and became so desperate to reclaim their favor that they sacrificed 200 children. Yet to date, no physical evidence of such violence has been found. In fact, the Canadian-British historian and archaeologist Eve MacDonald argues provocatively in her new book that this brutal episode was an imagined scene by a hostile ancient source. That source, of course, was Rome, which annihilated Carthage in the Third Punic War from 149 to 146 BCE. Rome's leaders never wanted anyone to see Carthage or its citizens as real people, MacDonald writes, but rather as a savage foe, its name useful in boosting Roman morale. Now, in Carthage, A New History of an Ancient Empire, MacDonald surveys archaeological work from the past 20 years, including her own, to paint a richer portrait of the city and its people than we've ever seen before. A star in classicist circles, MacDonald published her first book, a biography of the General Hannibal, in 2015. MacDonald takes us from the Phoenicians who founded the city in the 9th century BCE through the myths and possible truths about a canny political dissident from Tyre who came to be known as the Queen Dido. We learn of the rise of Carthage as a formidable naval power and, yes, of its eventual sacking. But we also learn about the 1st century afterward when the Punic language of the city's institutions permeated North Africa. It is believed that Africa was never so Punic as it was after Carthage was destroyed, MacDonald writes, as surviving Carthaginians created a kind of Punic diaspora. New archaeology and old literature present a different Carthage in the post-war years, she writes. Recent isotopic analysis has revealed, among other things, that Carthage could rely on its own significant resources from lead-silver mining when it was faced with trade barriers during war. MacDonald's book is an engrossing and ambitious effort, as concerned with the histories of sailors and soldiers as with the lives of generals and aristocrats. The Roman memories only ever told one side of the story, she writes. The complexity of this once great, sophisticated and multicultural African city with the history of innovative technologies, brave warriors, and deep religious beliefs was gone. Accompanying this article, Know Your Ancients. Who was the real Dido? Perhaps the most famous Carthaginian in history was Dido, founder of the city. In her lifetime, she was probably known as Alyssa. Alyssa came to Africa from Tyre in modern Lebanon, probably in the late 9th century BCE. In some sources, she is the sister of Pygmalion, king of Tyre. The name Dido was given retroactively by Greek historians and cemented in history in Virgil's Aeneid. This concludes readings from Smithsonian Magazine for today. Your reader has been Rebecca Shore. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.